Inviting me to speak this evening. It's always a pleasure to speak to the Agnon group. Every time I tell people that there is such a thing, that there is an Agnon group, everyone is very impressed, and they should be, because Agnon is a challenge, and I find it to be a rewarding challenge, but definitely a challenge. And the fact that this group has kept it up and now kept it up on Zoom is no small thing. I would like to ask people, I'm just letting in more people who are joining, I would like to ask people if they could please ask questions during the session. Don't wait for the end. I'll tell you if at some point I need to go further. But I prefer to have the discussion as an ongoing thing during the session. Also, I'm grateful that there are a lot of people who have their screens on. The more the merrier. I like to be able to talk to people, not to gray boxes. So you know, if you're able to, I don't mind that you're eating dinner. No, we're not recording video, so you know, go right ahead.
Will you not be recording?
I'm recording only audio. I don't record video.
Okay.
I find that if I record video, people don't want to keep their screens on. So. So I'm going to mute everybody by default. Unmute when you have questions and comments, please. I am really glad that Shoshana asked me to learn this story. First of all, it's a nice story. It's just a nice story. It has a happy ending. It has a nice moral, which, honestly, in many Agnon stories, you don't get a happy ending. I think the last one we did together was Hani Dach, which was a terrible ending. That was so depressing. We did Magalei Tzedek, which you can sort of look at as having a happy ending, because he made it to Israel, but he was being buried there. I don't know. But this is just a nice story. Second, it addresses themes which we can really trace through more of Agnon's writing, giving a better sense of the writer himself beyond this particular story. And then third, this is a wild story in the sense that it's published in 1937 in Haaretz. People liked it so much that they ripped off the story and they turned it into a nonfiction account from the lives of other people. So there's actually some literature about this online. I was going to put it on the source, I did not to, but I'll tell you. Apparently, this story made it into a 3-volume set called Sha'al Avicha V'Yagedcha, Stories from the Maggid of Yerushalayim, Rav Shwadron. And there he says, Et ha-sipur siper li tamid chacham chashuv. An important Talmud Chacham, an important Torah scholar, told me the story, Shashama Zos mi bal ha-uvda atzmo. He heard this story from the person who was actually involved. I shouldn't use the Ashkenazi miftah, sorry. That because of his work, he spends a lot of time in the library, and there he reads manuscripts and so on, and that can't possibly be. This is an Agnon story, and we'll see in a second whether it ever happened. But apparently it makes it in there. I even saw somebody who said that Rabbi Pesach Kron, who has written many English Magid books, includes it in his, although I don't know which one. Also, Rav Yitzhak Zilberstein has a collection of what are best called Chizuk Ma'amarim, stories and passages that are meant to inspire people. It's called Tuvcha Yabiu. And lo and behold, this appears in Rav Zilberstein's Tuvcha Yabiu. I even saw someone who said that it's in the new art scroll Siddur of Rav Chaim Knievsky. I do not actually know that for a fact, but somebody said that it's in there. I haven't seen the Siddur, so I don't know. Rav Yeshua Manschein, about 20 years ago, traced a whole bunch of places where this story shows up. None of them crediting Agnon, to be clear. Yes, Shoshana.
The book you just quoted in Hebrew, if you went very quickly, what was the name again? Where the story appears.
Yeah. So one of them was Sha'al Avicha V'Yagedcha, and the other one is Tuvcha Yabiu. And then the third one.
What's the words? They're hard to. Can you repeat them slowly?
Like in Ashrei, Zecher Rav Tuvcha Yabiu. So Tuvcha Yabiu.
Tuvcha Yagido.
Yabiu. Yeah.
Yabiu. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. And what's the third?
The Art Scroll Sitter of Rav Chaim Kanievsky.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. It's really wild. If anybody wants, I can give you the links on this, but it's just fascinating. The story itself, as I said, is published in Haaretz in 1937. That's perhaps the funniest thing when you think about it. The Maggid of Yerushalayim, Rav Yitzchak Zilberstein, and Rav Chaim Kanievsky with a story that appeared in Haaretz. Go figure. How many times does that happen? I know, in 1937, Haaretz may have been different. But it's included in the collection of stories Elu Ve'elu, which is published in 1941. The big question with this story is it fiction or nonfiction? Did this story actually happen? If it really happened, maybe somebody who was involved told it to others, and that's, you know, how it ends up there. I suppose that's a possibility. See, Agnon builds the story around events in his life. For those of you who have read it or who read, you know, my English translation, he talks about in his youth how he davened, he prayed with his father in a Hasidish Akloiz, right? We know Agnon did that. He talks about his journey from Buchach to Israel, where he's in Yafo, and going back to Germany, and then back to Israel. Like, that fits. Personally, I would have bet against it being true. First of all, some elements of it are not true to his biography. He says he went to Yafo because it was a metropolis for people seeking work. But we know that when Agnon came to Israel, he first tried his hand as a farmer and then became a writer. He was not going looking for work. He also is known for dramatizing events in his life in the style of this story. So it leaves me skeptical. And actually, at one point, he quotes a Rabbi Shmuel. And I can't find the quote that he gives anywhere, which makes me think he might be quoting himself, Shmuel Yosef Agnon. Which he does elsewhere. In the book Bilavav Yamim, he quotes Rabbi Shmuel Yosef ben Mordechai Halevi or something like that. And that's, of course, himself. Which would mean that the protagonist is not him. Because it's the protagonist quoting Rabbi Shmuel. However, I will note this. I found an online discussion group talking about this story in which somebody claimed that the story was true, and that the woman in the story was actually Agnon's favorite niece, Kitty Steinschneider. I don't know what to make of that. It would change the story if it's actually a relative of his. But I throw that out there for your own consideration. I don't really know what to do with that. I did give you the links for this. Sorry. If you look on the source sheet after the translation part, the first source is the trail that I identified where this is discussed, including the link to Rabbi Manschein's article, including the link also to Kitty Steinschneider. So if anybody wants to look it up, I did give you references there where you can find this. I forgot that I had put that on the sheet. Okay. So for anyone who's tuning in and has been sitting here for 10 minutes wondering what in the world is this all about, I didn't read the story before and I didn't read the translation, so I don't know what you're talking about. I'm going to give you a quick outline of the story first before we go through the story. It begins with, it's a very short story. When he talks, we're going to talk about chapters in the story, but the chapters are very brief. It begins, chapter one, with an argument for keeping to one's ancestral nusach. The word nusach, I translate it as liturgy. It means the text of prayer. Even though the word nusach is also used in other ways, that's the way I'm translating it here. It's liturgy. So the argument is, stick to your ancestral liturgy. Chapter 2 is the protagonist admitting, I didn't actually keep to my ancestral nusach for prayer, for various reasons which he outlines, but I did it for Birkat HaMazon, the blessing after meals. For that, I stuck to the way that my father did it. And he gets there his two key words that he did from his father, which we're going to talk about. But that's the introduction. Chapter 3 is what I think of as Act 1. Agnon, or not Agnon, whoever he is, the protagonist, and his wife are hosting a female student, female university student in their home in Israel. She's from Germany, and she hears him reciting Birkat HaMazon, the blessing after meals, and he includes two words, in a request in the blessing of Rachim, where we ask God for mercy, and specifically we ask God for help with our livelihood, we say traditionally, Shaloni Kalem, that we should not be shamed, right? Shaloni Vosh, Veloni Kalem, we should not be embarrassed, we should not be humiliated. What the difference is between the two is a good question. Velo, and then he throws in two more words, Veloni Kashel. God, help us so that we don't stumble. And she makes fun of him. She says, what are you talking about? Those two words aren't in the benching, in the Birkat HaMazon, in the blessing after meals. We don't do that. And he goes, he says, of course it is. It's right here. And he opens up the text, and it's not there. And he brings this book, and that book, and the other book, and it's in none of them. And she makes fun of him. And she leaves. She goes on her way. She sends him a letter, his wife a letter, thanking them for their hospitality. And she finishes her doctorate. She does her doctorate on customs that are based on superstition. And she sends him a copy of it. He is not thrilled with that with that book. He does not respond to the book. That's all Act 1. In Act 2, which is Chapter 4, on his father's yard site, he finds a birkon. He finds a blessing after meals, the Birkat HaMazon, that includes the words, Veloni Kashel, that we not stumble. He's so excited, he sends it to her. She writes back to him eventually, thanking him for having sent it, and she says, I'm making aliyah, and I'm getting married, and I am inviting you to my wedding. That's Act 2. Then Act 3 is chapters 5 and 6, and this concludes the story. At the wedding, she honors him with leading the Birkat HaMazon, the blessing after meals, at the end of the wedding, the Sheva Brachos. It's the Sheva Brachos, the seven blessings that are recited. He feels that she is watching him as he says those magic words, that we not stumble, Veloni Kashel. And then she tells him that that Birkat HaMazon that he sent arrived right when she was planning to marry a non-Jew. And those words, that we not stumble, convinced her not to do it. And lo and behold, you saved me. So what we're going to do is read through the story first, with my translation, with some technical notes, and then discuss the broader themes and questions that the story raises. That's where I want to go with this. Let me just pause now and ask questions and comments at this stage. I don't think we've said anything, really, but if there are. Sorry, Uri, is that a hand up, nope, okay. So let's go further. I will note, and Shoshana, thank you for your kind words about my translation. The translation was just something quick that I put together. I did not take pains to preserve Agnon's art. It is not as nice as the Hebrew. It was really done more as a study aid for me to help me make sure I grasp the story, than anything else. That's number one. Number two, we're not going to go through all 40 footnotes that I have in here when we go through this. There's no time for that. I do think that the things I put there are worth reading. So, when you get the opportunity, definitely do please read through it. I'm putting the link in again because a couple of people, joined recently. So, first of all, the opening two chapters, this introduction. So, he begins. I'm reading out my English translation. I have the Hebrew here, if anyone has questions about the original as well. One should never deviate from his ancestors' liturgy of prayer. Keep to their liturgy. For prayer ascends to the gates of heaven, and there are 12 gates there, which are called the gates of prayer, parallel to the 12 tribes. Now, let me read a little further, then I'm going to comment on that. Every person receives from his parent, who received from his ancestors, who received from the head of their tribe, the son of our father Yaakov of blessed memory, the order of his prayer. For when the sons of Yaakov prayed, God prepared 12 gates in the heavens, and each gate is positioned opposite each tribe according to its attributes. So each tribe of Jews has a particular liturgy that is appropriate for them, and therefore they should stick to that liturgy. He says, it turns out that anyone who deviates from the liturgy that his ancestors prayed, which the head of his tribe prayed, confuses the gates. His prayer enters in a jumble. So if you can hold where we are now and jump to the part after the story, the sources that I give afterwards. Take a look at source number 2, please. I thank Shoshana for lending me her copy of a wonderful book, which I was completely unaware of. Sefer Sofer V'Sipur. I came across a reference to this in an article that I'm going to reference later as well by Dr. Dina Levin. She made reference to it, and so I looked. It's Agnon collecting a series of, and it's a book full of, statements, passages, quotations about books and authors. A little bit of biography in there. It's really fascinating, including a lot about the Sidur. So what I brought you here is in Sefer Sofer V'Sipur, page 362 of the 1962 edition, in which Agnon talks about the origin of the 12 gates of prayer. He himself is building this on Hasidish sources. It's not, in other words, his own idea. And if you take a look at source number 2, I'm going to read out my translation, but you can see the original. Regarding the fact that there are different liturgies in prayer, the questioner asked how to conduct himself in these matters. He's quoting somebody here. I said, one cannot explain such things in writing, but this is already known. As our sages said, he's quoting from the Talmud Yerushalmi, the Jerusalem Talmud, there were 13 locations for bowing in the temple, opposite the 13 gates. 13 gates in order to enter the area of the temple. It is hinted in Yechezkel, the prophet Ezekiel, that in the future, God willing, there will be one gate for Reuven, one gate for this, one gate for that. For then the sanctity of all of Jerusalem will be like the past sanctity of the temple. Meaning, what the Talmud is saying there is that there are 13 gates, and one gate is for each tribe. You will say, wait a minute, there are 13, there's a 13th, we'll come back to that. The 12 gates are a gate for each tribe. And it is known that the temple is aligned opposite the temple in the heavens, so that the temple in the heavens also has a gate for each tribe, as explained in the writings of the Arizal, and so on. To make a longer story short, what the Ari proposed is that just as there are 13 entrances to the temple down on earth, there are 13 entrances to God's temple when one prays. 12, one for each tribe, and then one that's for everybody, that everybody is able to use. And what the Ari argued, Rabbi Yitzchak Luria in the 16th century argued, is that the liturgy that he developed is for everybody. Doesn't matter what tribe you're from, you can use the Ari's liturgy, which becomes known as Nusach Sfard. The reason it becomes known as Nusach Sfard, anybody know? It's very funny always to me, because the Ari was his last name was Ashkenazi. Right, Rabbi Yitzchak Ashkenazi. So why, as a matter of fact, some say that the acronym Ari is Ashkenazi Rabbi Yitzchak. So why is it that the edition of prayer that he created is called Nusach Sfard? I think I put it in one of the footnotes, actually. Because a lot of his followers there were exiles from Sfarad. They were people who had fled Spain, and either through Spain or Portugal or Turkey, they ended up in Israel in Sfat. So it became known as the Sfard liturgy. But what he says here, going back towards our story, Agnon says that you have these gates that are associated with each tribe, and therefore you should stick to the gate that's appropriate for your tribe. And if you don't, your prayer enters in a jumble. The word is actually in the original, irbuvia. Agnon here is doing what Agnon does best, which is channeling rabbinic writing for a graphic image that most readers will never appreciate because they don't know his source. But if you take a look at source number 3, his source is the Gemara in Avodah Zarah. The Gemara there has a prediction that in the future, in the Messianic time, the different nations are going to come to God and appeal to God and say, give us the Torah, and then we would follow it. They're going to beseech God. And if you look at source number 3, you find the Talmud saying, based on a verse in Isaiah, immediately all of the idolaters will gather and come in a jumble, bi'irbuvia. And God is going to say to them, do not enter before me in a jumble. Each nation should enter with its sages. And then the story there continues. Point being, and the reason why Agnon is doing this, is he's saying, if you don't follow your text. If you don't follow your liturgy, then you're like these idolaters who come before God in a jumble. That's what it's, that's what Agnon is telling the reader. Did I say that too fast, or is that clear? We good?
But you're going to have a recording.
So that is also true.
We don't catch, we can always go.
Okay, no, but I hope the concept is clear. He's trying to play up the importance of liturgy and sticking to your liturgy. And so I'm going back to the first page now, where towards the end of chapter one, he says, the recent generations have been punished, those who switched the liturgy of prayer and introduced mass destruction. He uses this glorious word, andralamusia, which I gave you some amphoret in footnote number 5. You could take a look at it there. But they introduced mass destruction in the heavens and the world below, and increased division in Israel, and drained the strength of Israel below and above. This is what you do if you don't stick to your liturgy, and the world has still not returned to its proper state. So chapter 1 says, stick to your liturgy of your tribe. And then in chapter 2, he says, yeah, but there are all sorts of values that override sticking to the liturgy of your tribe, and I followed all of those other values instead. So take a look at chapter 2. He says, the order of prayer I pray has deviated from that which my ancestors prayed. Not only that, but I go and trade liturgy for liturgy and order for order. I do one Nusach, I do another Nusach, I do one Seder, I do another Seder. I just keep on changing liturgies. I see your hand, Andy. I'm gonna hold a little bit, but thank you. How may one deviate from his ancestral liturgy and switch order for order? How do I get to do that? The tossing about that I have endured from my beginnings until today caused this. How so? At first I prayed with my father of blessed memory in the Klois of the Hasidim, back when I lived in Buchach. The Hasidim and the Klois is the shtibel, essentially. The Hasidim and the Klois prayed according to the Sfard custom, because that's what Hasidim did following the Ari. And so I also prayed according to the Sfard custom, that's what I did as well. When I grew a bit, I went to study Torah in the old study hall where they prayed in the Ashkenaz liturgy, which they received from their ancestors, and their ancestors from their ancestors, from the days of the first Ashkenazi leaders. They were careful not to add anything, not to subtract anything, not to alter anything, even one word. We're going to come back to that, how important liturgy was to the Ashkenazim. It's a big deal. I said, could I, the smallest of the students, stand and deviate from the custom? I joined my prayer with their prayers and prayed according to their custom, so I gained a second liturgy. Andy, you were going to say?
Yeah, I was stopped by where it says the recent generations have been punished.
Yeah.
What is he referring to, recent generations? And then when he talks about how he's been tossing about that he received the history of Jews since the dispersion began.
Right. So two separate things. In terms of his point about the earlier the recent generations, I had the same question when I read that. Is he referring to something specific? It could be he's referring to World War I. That is certainly possible. Historically, it would fit the time frame. He could also, though, just be referring to pogroms. This is a terrible period for Jews. Eastern Europe in the beginnings, the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century is awful. So it could be he's referring to the pogroms of the period just as easily. In terms of his tossing about, he isn't referring to that as a punishment. He's referring to that simply as the cause of him being exposed to other liturgies, which he then ends up adopting. That's not a punishment. Okay. Other questions at this point? Yeah.
I just meant that it's nothing unique to him.
Oh, yeah. No, that's true. That's true.
Either.
Correct. And he's going to be okay with the idea that anybody who's experiencing what he's experiencing may swap liturgies as well. He's going to be good with that. You'll see.
Is he thinking that liturgies is a worldview? That he himself, when he was in Germany, had a different lifestyle maybe than he had when he was in Israel, and somebody said you have a conflict of those, which way do you choose?
Right.
He was not the accused.
So that's an interesting thought. What Irv is suggesting, I think, is that maybe liturgy here is a stand-in for lifestyle. Is that what you're? That's what you're suggesting?
Not only lifestyle, you know, approach to.
Yeah, it's an interesting idea. It's an interesting idea for sure. Let's see how the story develops and see if you can see parallels. Because I think there is something to be said for that. I think there is. I mean, I'm going for a particular theme that I think actually will fit that well. But let's watch the liturgies multiply. When I grew older, I merited to ascend to the land of Israel. I established my life in Jaffa, because Jaffa was a metropolis for people seeking work. Jaffa was settled by Pharisees and Hasidim at that time. When he says Pharisees, he doesn't mean the original Pharisees. He means those who are not like the Hasidim, the people who are of the world of the yeshiva. That's what he means. He uses the term in other stories as well. Even though these prayed the Ashkenazi liturgy and these the Sfard liturgy, the liturgy of these was not like the Ashkenazi liturgy of our old study hall. The liturgy of these was not like the Sfard liturgy of the Klois in our town. For in the Klois in our town, they prayed according to the liturgy of the Hasidim of Poland, Volhynia, and Ukraine, as established by the Tzaddikim of the generation, right? The leaders of the Hasidim. The Tzaddik is the Rebbe. Students of the Baal Shem Tov of blessed memory. And the Hasidim of Jaffa prayed according to the prayer of the Rav from Liadi of blessed memory, also known as the Alter Rebbe, the first Lubavitcher Rebbe. In our old study hall, that's why the Nusach Sfard, the Sfard version has changed. As far as the Ashkenazi one, he says, in our old study hall, they prayed the Ashkenazi liturgy they received from their ancestors, and their ancestors from their ancestors, from the days of the first exiles of Germany. And in Jaffa, they prayed according to the Ashkenazi liturgy established by the Gaon Rabbi Eliyahu of blessed memory, the Vilna Gaon. Sometimes I prayed with the Pharisees, because they prayed early. Sometimes I prayed with the Hasidim, because they prayed late. In order not to separate from the community, I prayed in each place according to its liturgy. As a result, I became accustomed to pray in different liturgies. I knew it was prohibited to change from one liturgy to another liturgy, but because of the prohibition of lo tit go didu, a prohibition against dividing ourselves into sects by having different practices in the same group, and because public prayer is beloved, so I needed to pray with everybody else, I permitted myself to deviate. I said it's okay. You notice how many explanations he's giving for not sticking to the prayers of his ancestors, right? Who am I to deviate from what they're doing in the yeshiva, in Ashkenaz, in Buchach? You can't deviate from the norm and make sects within the community. Davening with this community is beloved to God. And then he goes on. There were another two congregations in Jaffa, Sfaridim and Yemenites. They were also divided into multiple synagogues. They were divided from each other by the liturgy of prayer. Even though all of them were included in the community of Sfardim, we call all of them Sfardim, not everybody does, but that's what he's saying, the liturgy of Yemenites was not like the liturgy of the Sfardim. Both of them were different from the Sfard liturgy of Lubavitch Hasidim, which was also different from the Sfard liturgy of the Hasidim of our town, because Sfardim is those who left Spain, and their addition, their liturgy, is different from the Yemenites, and it's entirely different from Rabbi Yitzhak Luria, the Ari's addition that the Hasidim are using. And since I lived in their neighborhood, I was careful not to be called a bad neighbor. I would enter to pray at times in this synagogue, at times in this synagogue. And when I came to pray, they would extend to me a siddur, a prayer book of theirs. I showed respect to the host and prayed in the order of their prayers. I noted in the footnote the importance that if you have a synagogue in your community, you're not allowed to be a bad neighbor and neglect it. You have to participate there. And then he describes, and I see it's getting late, it's already 8:30, but he describes how he left Israel after 6 years. I'm not clear on why he imports this, you know, like the law of a Hebrew slave, whether that's just Agnon's way of expressing himself or whether it's relevant for the story. It's the sort of thing Agnon would write, but I don't see how it fits the story. But he says, I've been in Israel for 6 years. It was decreed upon me that I depart to the diaspora. And of course, in Agnon's personal biography, we know he goes with Zalman Shachin to Germany. I descended to the land of Germany. I rolled about from place to place, sometimes in this region, sometimes in this region. The land of Germany was also divided in the liturgy of prayer into the Ashkenazi custom and the Polish custom. And so that I would not be one of those who shock min hamat mihin, a phrase we find in the Talmud. I prayed in each place according to the custom of the place. Here Ashkenaz and here Polish. And then I come with the Rosh Hasidim and I prayed with them also, and I really liked their prayer. It was pleasant, so I was drawn after it and I prayed with them. And then he talks about how he came back to Israel and he lived in Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem he found that there were 480 synagogues and study halls. And you look at that and say, where'd you get that from? And the answer is, it's in the Medrash, as I gave you in the footnote. Eicha Rabba says it. Agnon is an expert in the Medrash on Eicha in particular. He's very close to the Medrash on Eicha. He quotes it a lot. And he says, in each one of these synagogues, they have their own liturgy. And each time I used their liturgy. And then finally, he concludes chapter 2 by saying, and still I move from liturgy to liturgy, from Sidur to Sidur, other than for Birkat HaMazon, the blessing after meals, for which I have not deviated from the liturgy of my father of blessed memory, just as he was accustomed to say in the request of Rachem, this blessing, that we not be shamed, we not be embarrassed, and that we not stumble, so I am accustomed, even though the request of that we not stumble is not mentioned in most Sidurim. So that's chapter 2, and you notice he basically has two justifications for switching liturgies. One, putting community first. Who am I to deviate from the community? You're not supposed to deviate from the norm. You don't want to shock people. Playing with the community is beloved to God, so I should be with them. And then the other is personal desire. Whether it's the convenience of a minion that prays at the time that works for him, early or late, or whether it's because the prayers of the Hasidim were pleasant to him, or it's because he loves holy places and he wants to pray in all 480 synagogues and study halls, I'm good with joining any liturgy, even though I told you you're supposed to stick to your ancestral liturgy. Are we clear? We're good? Because the story's about to start moving. This was all his introduction. It takes a lot of time on the introduction, and then the story just goes. So we good? Okay. Chapter 3, or as I call it, Act 1. One time, we hosted a pretty young woman, daughter of good people, daughter of leaders of Ashkenaz, whose ancestors served in the rabbinate of several holy communities in the diaspora. So she is from good German stock. Ashkenaz is Germany. She heard me say that we not stumble in the blessing after meals. She asked the place for this request. Why do you say that? And I told her, so I have received from my father's house. She said, how do you say, so I have received? This request is not mentioned in the Sidur. Now, pause there. Why is she objecting? What is her objection? What does she care whether it's in the Sidur or not?
Adding something new, maybe you don't do that in the Jewish world.
So one way to paint it is as Irv just painted it. She's a traditionalist. The Germans, you have to remember, German Jews, and we've already alluded to it, were powerful traditionalists. If you want to know who in your synagogue is most likely to protest if you change the tune in davening, or if you say one word a little differently from the way that it is, it's going to be the strong Ashkenazi. I'm not going to use the word. I know that you're waiting for it. I'm not going to. But that's who's going to care about it. It's a centuries-old Ashkenazi tradition. If you jump to source number 4 in the sources that I brought at the end, I brought you from Rabbi Yehuda HaChassid in 12th century Germany. He says, one who alters the early custom, such as in Piyutim and Krovetz. The Piyutim and Krovetz are two different types of liturgical poems that were recited as part of the services. And he says, for example, they used to say Einitzur in the synagogue, which is one poem, instead of the Krovetz of Yehuda HaKalir. And this is the custom. And this person says another Krovetz instead. That person violates, do not overstep the eternal border made by your ancestors. Do not overstep the border of your friend established by the first ones. You're not allowed to change the boundaries of prayer. And it even is applied to the tunes of prayer. That's the stock that this woman comes from. And so she says, how dare you change the text just because your father said something different? That's one way to read it. What's the other way to read it? How else could you read her objection? It's the exact opposite. So the other way to read it is that she is a modernist. In the modern age, a younger generation arises which rejects what we call the mimetic tradition. Mimetic tradition means doing things that my ancestors did. I don't have a textual basis for it. It's simply what we do. Dr. Chaim Soloveitchik, the son of Rav Yosef Dov Soloveitchik, I'm just noting something on my sheet for myself. He wrote an essay which is very influential called Rupture and Reconstruction, in which he talked about what he saw as the demise of the mimetic tradition, in which people did what their parents did or what they saw in their community, as opposed to that which they could find in a book. An example of this, there are many stringencies that people have in a kosher kitchen, which letter of the law would not require. But this is the way we keep a kosher kitchen. The student who comes home and says, but I learned in the Shulchan Aruch, we're allowed to do it this way, we ignore him. This is the way we keep a kosher kitchen. And on the other hand, that's in terms of stringencies, but also in terms of leniencies. There are things that Jews do which don't seem to conform to strict understanding of Jewish law. And as a result, the writers of halacha texts have tried to justify, well, this is okay because they give what's called a limud zechut, an attempt to justify what people are doing. The point is that there was this mimetic tradition. I do things because that's what I saw at home, because that's what they did in the community. And a younger generation arises, and in my head I associate this with the maskilim, although I can't find a particular source to bring to support that. But they say, what are you doing? You do this just because of the previous generation doing it? That's an act of ignorance. It may even be superstitious, unless you can find the original text. So two ways to understand her rejection of this text. Either she's rejecting the text because she's a traditionalist. She's, you know, saying, do what you have, only the original liturgy. Or because she's a modernist, she says, I don't like these things that people do just because their ancestors did them. That's the two ways that you can take it. Right now, I don't know which she is, but it's going to become very clear within the text which one she is. So let's go back to the story. I told her, I've received this from my, we did that. I told her it certainly is mentioned. Of course it's in the Sidur. We're in the third paragraph on the page under chapter 3. She produced the Sfat Emet Sidur, which was the classic German Sidur from the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, the Rodelheim Sidur, and showed me this request was not mentioned there at all. So I joked and I said, you're fortunate, dwellers of the land of Germany. You never needed this text praying to God that we not stumble. For all of you are scholars, from your great ones to your little ones, you do not come to stumbling. Therefore, your Sidurim have let this request go. But we Poles, woe is me that I say this, we need this prayer. May we merit before God such that he hears our request. Therefore, they established it in our Sidurim. In our Sidur, it's there because we need to ask God for help to make sure that we don't stumble. Dr. Dina Levine, whose article I referenced earlier, notes that in Bachanutol Shamar Lublin, a different piece from Agnon, a book, he actually gives a different reason for why Germany wouldn't have this text, and that's because Rav Elimelech of Lezhinsk and his brother Reb Zusha spread Hasidus, and they didn't get to Germany. Their period of wandering ended before they could get to Germany, and therefore the Hasidim didn't make it to Germany, and therefore they don't have the text. In any case, continuing, the young woman said, didn't I tell you these... I'm sorry, I jumped. I took a Sidur to show her, and I didn't find this request. I took another Sidur, I didn't find this request in it. Because I am accustomed to many liturgies for prayer, I collected many Sidurim. I rose and checked in all of those Sidurim. I did not find in Merkat HaMazon a mention of these two words, of and that we not stumble. Can't find it anywhere. That young woman said, didn't I tell you these words are not part of the request? And when she said this, she peered at me like someone who says to his friend, this coin has been disqualified. She looks at me in a very negative light. I gave you the reference for that, the source for that in the footnote 26. I'm not going to go into the word peered Hitzitsa. That's actually, there is a lot to be said, but we just don't have the time for that this evening. Sometime later, she went to the valley and to the Galil. This is a term, as I put in footnote 27, for touring. In the 1930s, they would call it La Emek Vala Galil. It was a thing. And from there, she descended to the Adelayada in Tel Aviv, which is an annual Purim festival, which started in 1912, as I gave you the reference in source number 20, in footnote 28. From there, she returned to Germany to complete her studies. From there, she wrote us a letter of thanks for our hospitality with her, me and my wife. After some time, she sent us a book she composed for her doctorate on customs among nations and in Israel, which are founded on false ideas. This book did not sit well with me. I wanted to write to her that I had heard from one sage named Rabbi Shmuel, which again I think is himself. What are false ideas? Anything not mentioned in the code of Jewish law. That's a false idea. But I said, if I will start critiquing every book they send me, I'll never manage it. But if I averted my eyes from her book and didn't thank her, I was obligated to bless her upon earning her doctorate. But my wife was busy with household matters. I have difficulty writing letters. I left the matter and said, tomorrow I'll write, after tomorrow I'll write. The time will come, I'll write to her. And along the way, I never wrote anything to her. So there's a lot to be said here. But when we learn more about the girl's pursuits, we start to understand that her objection was not because she's a traditionalist. She goes to the Adelayada parade in Tel Aviv. She has a doctorate on customs that she says come from superstition. It becomes very clear that her objection is the modernist objection. If you have a text for it, fine. If not, this is probably something that came from superstition. That's the way that this story is presenting it. By the way, for those of you who learned the story Hatizmoret with me, where he talked about his procrastination in writing letters, that's the one about the Rosh Hashanah symphony performance. So he talks there a lot about his procrastination in writing letters, but it's not something we're going to get into here. I'm just noting that it's a theme for Agnon. But something to think about here. His justification for these two words being added by the Poles, right? Because we need it. We need to pray to God that we not stumble. He's contradicting his original thesis about sticking with your original text, because apparently they changed it in order to add in these two words. Think about that. But I'm going to go to chapter 4. In this period, the yahrzeit of my father of blessed memory came. I went to the city to pray. Along the way, it occurred to me that for a long time I had prayed in many liturgies. Now that I would lead the services, I would be confused in my prayer. I shall go and acquire a sidur for myself. This is very unclear to me, because he said he has a lot of sidurim. I can't imagine why he really needs to get a new one. But this is a very unknown thing. I entered a book. It's probably more about his love of books. I entered a bookstore. A birkat hamazon came to my hand, like the one that hung above our table in my father's house. I peered and saw that recorded in the prayer of Rachem was that we not stumble. The words are there. I purchased the book and left happy. After the prayer, I returned to my home and ate the evening bread. Once I ate and drank, I took the birkat hamazon that I had bought and blessed from it in honor of the new book and in honor of these two words and that we not stumble that I had found in it. I was so excited that I found it. By the way, Dr. Michal Arbel notes that this is parallel to the story that appears right after this one in Elu Ve'elu called Chush HaReach, which was published originally in Haaretz actually just before this story. In that story, Agnon is trying to justify his use of a certain set of words to describe something against those who have criticized him. And in a dream, the dream leads him to find the verse that justifies his use of the phrase. So this is another example of that, just like this miraculous, look, I found it. So he says, when I reached the prayer of Rachem, the letters came and said, you see, your father's words have a basis. A thought arose in my heart. I will send that young woman this book to show her I never made up words, and in order to satisfy her regarding her letter and her book. Now I'm going to do my answer. Immediately I converted thought into action, and I took an envelope and I wrote her name and her last name and her title of honor, the name of her city, the name of the street on which she lived. I dipped the end of the quill in red ink and I drew a line beneath the words, "and that we not stumble," so that she would see it if she read it. After some time, she sent me a letter of thanks for the gift I had sent her. She also wrote she was preparing to move to Israel, her mate with her. They were going to make their chuppah in Jerusalem. It was not long before she came with her mate, and they invited me to come to their chuppah. Which brings us to Act 3. I'm rushing a little bit because I want to get to the point, not just read the story. There is no chen. I didn't translate the word chen. There's no really good English translation for the word chen. There is no chen like that of a bride in her chuppah. There is no joy like the joy of a groom upon a bride. But they were also like most of our generation, who do not taste the taste of the joy of a mitzvah. They reduced the joy of their chuppah. They didn't do it publicly. They didn't make a big public wedding. And Agnon is clearly critical in this. He is not happy with them for this. I'm going to come back to that. They entered the home of the rabbi in their neighborhood. He conducted their wedding. They departed and went on their way. They took 10 men, including me. They entered their house to hold a wedding meal. Once we ate and drank, they honored me to bless the 7 blessings at the Birkat HaMazon. They poured 2 cups for me. I took 1 cup in my hand. I recited loudly and musically, Devei Haser Vagam Charon, Devei Haser, remove grief and also rage, and I blessed Shasimcha Be'ono. This is all part of the standard liturgy for the 7 blessings. The one who has joy in his abode, I blessed Birkat HaMazon. When I reached the prayer of Rachem, I said, as is my custom, and that we not stumble. I felt the bride looking at me affectionately. Even though my eyes were closed in the manner of those who recite blessings, I gave you a reference in the footnote for that, I felt her looking at me. I pressed my eyes closed more so that I would not be distracted from the one to whom we bless. He's a pious person. After Birkat HaMazon, I put down the 1st cup from my hand and picked up the 2nd cup, and this is the standard ritual. I blessed who created all for his glory, who created humanity, who gladdens Zion with her children, who gladdens the groom and the bride, all of the blessings of the Sheva Brachot. And then I again picked up the 1st cup and blessed upon the wine. And I drank of the 2 cups and I gave to the groom and bride and to all of those attending. And I blessed Alagef and I departed and went on my way. He does this very matter-of-factly. I feel like it's a response to the way they do the wedding. Like, and this, and this, and this. I did it minimally, just like they did it minimally, and I left, and I went, and I went out the door. And then you get chapter 6. The bride came out to escort me. I told her, go back. It's not fitting for a bride's honor to escort others. In fact, you have in the Talmud, I gave you a reference in the footnote, that everybody else is supposed to come escort the bride. She said, does Rebbe, my master, fear lest the mazikin affect me when I go back? And what she's referring to there is something I also put in the footnote. The idea that a bride and a groom are vulnerable to invisible, dangerous forces. Some will use the term demons for them. She says, is that what you're afraid of? And you know she wrote her doctorate on customs that are born of superstition. I said, God forbid, thus should not happen. But still, you know, one needs to be concerned. She said to me, I am not concerned. I have superior protection. I said to her, what is it? She produced a small book encrusted with precious stones and gems. I peered and saw it was the Birkat HaMazon I had sent her. I said, the book cost a pruta, a little coin. It's bound in gold. She said to me, this book deserves an even finer binding. I said to her, all our books deserve to be encrusted in precious stones and gems. Certainly the books of our prayers with which we come before God. What's special about this one? She said, this book all the more so. I said, why this book in particular? She lowered her head in embarrassment and said, because a miracle occurred for me through it. What miracle happened for her? A non-Jew was pursuing her to take her as a wife, and she set a time for him. When his time arrived, he came to her. He took her hands in his hands and sat with her. Then they knocked on the door, and they, invisible they, brought her something. She left and took it. She opened it and peered at it. The 2 words, that we not stumble, came and bowed low before her. She took it to heart and thought quickly about herself. She stood and dismissed the non-Jew, returned to her father. There she found her Jewish friend. In their youth they had exchanged pledges. Their love returned and was awakened. She ascended with him to the land of Israel. She married him according to the law of Moses in Israel. The woman said to me, every day we bless you, for in the merit of your gift I remained in my Judaism, and I merited to ascend to the land of Israel. I said to her, if there is to bless, bless our God. with whom are all blessings, for in his love with which he loves us, and in his gladness with which he is glad in us, he chose us from all of the nations and consecrated us with chuppah and marriage. How great are the words of the sages who said one should always be careful with the custom of his ancestors. If for two words a life was saved from Israel and she remained in her Judaism, how many Jewish souls would be saved from assimilation and from destruction if all Israel would be careful with the custom of their ancestors. So here's where I get to my understanding of what he's doing. I have a lot of questions. First of all, according to many sources in Halacha, an individual is certainly allowed to change their liturgy for various good reasons. I noted for you in the sources that I brought here, Rabbi Avram Gambiner, the Magen Avram, in the classic commentary to the Shulchan Aruch, to the Code of Jewish Law, in source number 5, he says it's a community that's not allowed to change its addition. He talks about communities changing, not individuals. Not only that, Rabbi Moshe Shick, the Maram Shick, a well-known halachic authority, says in source number 6 that an individual is allowed to choose to change their nusach to whatever liturgy appeals to them. You can adopt a different liturgy if it appeals to you. Not only that, Agnon's opening words in the story, Al Yishaneh, one should not change, are actually lifted from a passage in the Talmud which makes it into the Code of Jewish Law in source number 7, the Rama, Rabbi Moshe Isserles, codifier of Ashkenazi practice. But he uses them not to say, don't deviate from your liturgy. He uses them to say, Al Yishaneh Adami Minhag Ha'ir, one should not deviate from the local custom. You specifically shouldn't deviate from local custom. You should change your own liturgy to fit whatever the locals are doing. So far from saying you're not allowed to change, the actuality is you are. And in certain cases, you're supposed to deviate from that which you have received. That's one problem I have. Second, some of these liturgies that he describes are actually themselves new. Nusach Sfard was an innovation in the 16th century. Are you claiming that all the liturgies that you see here are from the 12 Sha'arim, are from the 12 gates? I find that difficult. Third, as we noted already, he keeps on jumping, right? He keeps on jumping himself. And consider this. Is he really keeping those two words, lo nikashel, that we not stumble, because it was his father's thing? If so, why does he need to find it in the text at all? His father's use is already sufficient. His father did it. That's really it. The writer Dov Sadan points out some of these inconsistencies in an article, and he actually argues that it demonstrates a flaw in the narrator. The narrator is breaking the rules. But I don't think so, because the narrator is presented as a hero in this story. He does everything right. He's doing everything the way it should be. I find that very, very difficult. I think what's going on in this story is that this is not a story about changing nusach, changing your liturgy. It's not. Changing your liturgy to an existing liturgy is fine, and the hero in the story does it all the time, and the German traditionalists are on board with it. This is a story about trusting what you saw growing up, trusting what your family did, trusting mimetic tradition to reflect an accurate tradition of what Judaism is supposed to be like. That's what Agnon is talking about. He's talking about trusting your ancestors. It's not a story about intermarriage either. That's what this is. The narrator in this story loves the sitter. Agnon loves the sitter. In that article I referenced from Dr. Dina Levine, she points to another story that appears in Elu Ve'elu, which is just beautiful. It's Agnon's ode to his own Sidur from his youth. It's called Sipur Na'eh Shel Sidur Tefilati. I was going to translate the beginning of it for the source sheet. I'm not sure why I didn't. I planned to. It's just beautiful. It's a tribute to his sitter. If you remember the story Hanidach, where the main figure in the story loves his mother's Sidur. Agnon loves the Sidur. He will go along with any Sidur, no matter how different it is from his own. When he's davening with others, I don't want to deviate from the locals. I want to experience different communities. I want to daven with my neighbors. I want to daven at a time that works for me. Whatever it is, he will go along with any sidur, and he has justification, because we have 12 different gates or 13 different gates. But when it comes to Birkat HaMazon, when it comes to the blessing after meals, suddenly he is loyal to his father's Birkat HaMazon. Is it because of nostalgia for his father? Is it because of nostalgia for his youth? Difficult to say that, because then it should apply to the Sidur also, not just to Birkat HaMazon. The answer may be that Agnon himself doesn't know why. He gave that sheepish answer to her when she asked about it. He said, well, in Poland we really needed it, in Germany you didn't need it. He's attached to this particular tradition. And he's certain it's right, because that's what my family did. And the young woman represents a new generation that challenges that kind of a tradition. She comes from a strong tradition herself. She is a bat tovim, a daughter of good people. But you know what's interesting? That phrase is used in the Talmud specifically to describe people who aren't like their ancestors. The ani ben tovim is the person who came from good stock and he himself doesn't have what they had. Her ancestors were giants of Ashkenaz. She's breaking away. She goes to the Adeloyada revelry in Tel Aviv on Purim. She writes a doctorate about customs that are founded in false ideas. I gave you a quote from Rav David Tzvi Hoffman in source number 8, where he talks about these false ideas and customs that come from them, but there's no time for it right now. But she is breaking away. She's saying, I don't trust that older tradition. So does he win? When he gives her the Sidur, see that? This is in the Sidur. Does he win? Yes and no. Yes, he convinces her that his tradition from his family was correct. Look, see? It is right. It's right there in the Sidur. And he finds it on his father's yahrzeit. Agnon loves dates on the calendar as being loaded dates. He finds it on his father's yahrzeit with a bencher that hung in his father's home. His father saved the day and she's so impressed. Look what she does. She goes back to her father's house. She goes back to a Jewish marriage to her beloved from youth. She makes Aliyah to Israel. You won, right? But no, because even after she receives that, and even after she makes Aliyah and she marries the Jew, she's still who she was, in the sense that the wedding he disapproves of, right? This younger generation, they don't like the traditions. They don't want to get married with a whole festive celebration. They keep it low key. She asks him, are you worried about me being attacked by the Mazikin, right? You're worried about harmful forces? You're superstitious. Right? Exactly the kind of practice she would have criticized in that doctorate. And at the end, she honors what? What is it that she wraps in gems and precious stones? The book. The textual tradition. That your tradition that you got from your family is valuable because it was in the book. You know? I find that really interesting. Even the fact that she lowers her head when she tells him the story of the miracle. It could be that that's because she's embarrassed that she was going to marry the non-Jew. But it also could be that she's embarrassed that she believes in a miracle suddenly. That, you know, that could be what she's actually embarrassed about. She's admitting that a miracle happened. But that's what Agnon is doing here. This book, this story is a tribute to doing what our ancestors did. And one more note, and then I'll take all the questions and comments people want, but I know we're supposed to be done at 9, so I'm doing the best I can. Agnon chooses the words that we not stumble as his anchor for this story. I think this is really, really important. You see, Agnon is responding to a halachic statement by Rabbi Avram David Warman of Buchach. I mentioned him also when we learned Hanidach, because he was critical to that story. Rav Avram David Warman of Buchach lived from 1770 to 1840. He was a classic yeshiva-trained misnaged. He wrote the Eshal Avram commentary to the Code of Jewish Law, to the Shulchan Aruch, printed in our standard editions of the Code of Jewish Law. Classic yeshiva. And then his son was very ill, and he brought him to Rav Levi Yitzchak of Berdichev, who healed him. And at that point, Rav Avram David became drawn to Hasidus, and there was a huge fight in Buchach about this. We talked about that in Hanidach. Well, Rabbi Avram David of Buchach, whose work is very, very familiar to Agnon, has a particular line, which I brought you in source number 9, on Birkat HaMazon, about the words Veloni Kashel. I gave you the text there in number 9, but I'm not going to read it out loud because of time, but you can see it there. He says, you know, these words, Veloni Kashel, appear twice in our liturgy. They appear in our Birkat HaMazon, he says. We're saying them. And they also appear in Ahavat Olam, a prayer that the Hasidim say before Shema, in which we ask God for help in our Judaism. Make sure we don't stumble when we're serving God. And he says those words make sense in the blessing before Shema. They don't make sense in that place in Birkat HaMazon. Because in Birkat HaMazon, we're asking God for help in our livelihood. And he says it's inappropriate to say, God, help me not to stumble in pursuing my livelihood. That makes it like look like you can't be an ethical businessman. Of course you can be ethical in business. You don't need God's help to keep you from stumbling. He wasn't in business. He says you don't need God's help to keep you from stumbling in business. Just be a good, be a mensch. That's all you need. This does not belong, he says, in Birkat HaMazon. It doesn't fit for it to be here. And then the key words. Take a look, please, in source number 9. This part I am going to read out loud. The beginning of my translation in number 9. He says, I habitually say these words, that we not be shamed, that we not be embarrassed, that we not stumble in Birkat HaMazon as well, in addition to Ahavat Olam. For so I heard. That's what I heard. That's what I saw growing up. But since it is not printed thus in any liturgy, God willing, without a vow, b'li neder, from now on, when I will remember, I will not say it in Birkat HaMazon. The Eish El Avram says, I am changing my liturgy because this does not appear in the text. I am rejecting my mimetic tradition. And what Agnon is doing is he's saying, no, that's wrong. It does belong in the text. I found it in the Birkat HaMazon. We do not change. Viva la mimetic tradition. This is his stance. And that's why he does it with these words in particular. So that's what I see here in the story. I have now monologued a lot. It is 9:03. Questions, comments, please.